Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world's changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. But just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. They don't have so very long judgment day, so won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. Just let it be. Na, 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me.
Good morning. Wake up. My name is Larry Ivory, and I'm the host of Wake Up. I am the president of the Illinois State Black Chamber of Commerce, and I have a co-host with me who's going to introduce himself, Malcolm Weems.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. I'm looking forward to the conversation today, Larry.
Well, you know, one of the things, we have a great conversation about things that really matter. Yeah. And I'm telling you that if you got your wife next to you and she ain't up, wake her up.
Wake her up.
If you got your son or your daughter, wake them up.
Wake them up.
Because there is a conversation we're going to have today that I think is relevant to black lives. Like I said, black lives matter. And so we're going to have a very talented group of people who are going to give us some great insight. And we're going to talk about the real issue, health. And that's an important issue, especially in the midst of the coronavirus.
I was going to say, COVID-19 is really a challenge for our people.
Absolutely. And let me just go ahead, and I'm going to introduce our three guests. And I want them, as they introduce themselves, to give us a little background of who you are. And then we're going to get right into the conversation, and we're going to share with people. So at this time, we're going to start with Dr. Jeffrey Sterling.
Good morning. Hope everyone is well. Thanks for having me. I'm Jeffrey Sterling. I'm an emergency physician by training. I literally was born and trained in emergency medicine at Cook County in Chicago. Have degrees from Northwestern University of Illinois, Harvard, and executive business training at Dartmouth Florida College of Business. I spent a lot of my time creating solutions. I have an international healthcare consultancy and implementation firm, Sterling Initiatives. I do multiple things in the space, including running another global medical supply company, and I am heavily involved in the health prevention and health promotion arena, helping several countries around the world through our company, Simco, which we'll talk about a little bit, I'm sure. So I'm a implementationalist and looking to make a difference in the lives of people wherever we go.
I like the way that sounds.
Absolutely. Next, we have Marlo. Marlo Kemp.
Yes. Good morning. Good morning, Larry and Malcolm. How are you both?
Good morning.
My name is Marlo Kemp. I have a background in government finance, which also intersects with healthcare. And so my career, since I got my MBA from the University of Chicago, has been working to empower and assist people of need. And so that's where my background comes in. One of the things that is very interesting that gets very little airplay is the intersection between economic empowerment and healthcare. And that's one of the things that really stands out. And that's one of the areas I hope to focus on in today here is the intersection of health and potential wealth.
Right on.
And we have none other than Dr. Carol Adams.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dr.
Good morning, Dr. Adams.
Well, I'm glad to be here and be part of this, what I call A-team, because the people that Dr. Sterling has assembled are pretty remarkable. I'm a sociologist, and I have worked in the human services field for quite a long time here in Chicago and in the state of Illinois, and I'm former Secretary of Human Services for the state of Illinois. So that gives me a lot of experience in terms of how we make certain that the appropriate services are available to the residents of our state. And I think we've got a lot more work to do in that direction, a lot more empowerment. That's really our theme today, how we are able to bring the things we need ourselves, able to service ourselves, able to build wealth and protect our health.
Thank you, Dr. Adams. Hey, let us get started. I'm going to ask the first question, and then I think my co-host here will ask the second question. We're going to get right involved in this conversation because this is a conversation about wealth and health care. You know, what I want to start off with is that often we hear about the devastating impact that the virus has had on black people. Can someone help me to understand why are we so adversely impacted? Can someone help the audience and us to understand a little bit of that? So whoever want to take that question, it's yours.
Well, let's just start with an understanding that COVID-19, in effect, was a stressor on our status. And what I mean by that is that black folks have historically been beset by healthcare disparities. And that means that we have, relatively speaking, poor access to care. We receive a lower quality of care, and we suffer from the cost restraints of care. So all of those things are already sitting there. And we also, we knew this back in the Reagan administration back in the 80s, that no matter the disease, ranging from hypertension, diabetes, many, many other diseases, cancer, HIV, that's just a long list, we actually suffer at higher rates, even when the quality of care is equal, which it rarely is. So we have these disparities. And when a stressor like COVID-19 comes around, it really just enlightens and exacerbates those disparities. So there's so many things that contribute to this, Larry. The fact that we're frontline workers and had to take trains and buses to work, the fact that we have public-facing jobs where we interact with mass numbers of people and didn't have the luxury of owning businesses or sitting or working from home, for example, early on. So many things like this contributed to a greater exposure to the disease, and because of the comorbidities and the health disparities and the social determinants and contributors to health being negatively stacked against us, all of that made our impact just much worse, the impact upon us much worse. It's a very complicated situation, but I can simplify it by saying that we started off 5 steps in the race, and then we had people slowing us down as we were trying to race. And the fact that we have now been shown to, relatively speaking, been losing the race can't come as a surprise.
Wow.
I want to add to that the fact, since this is Black History Month, we've got to look at our history and what has happened to us that impacts our susceptibility to particular kinds of medical conditions, okay? Because we still have both a physical and a cultural post-traumatic stress disorder. There is such a thing as this stuff being carried on with you transgenerationally, the kind of treatment that we suffered and the kind of things we endure, the kind of jobs we had then, during and after slavery, where we are now, the healthcare deserts, the food deserts, and now we're even hearing about the pharmacy deserts, right. Not to mention the way that we are treated in certain of these medical facilities, all sort of has impacted on our care, on our willingness to accept certain kinds of help, and even on whether or not we have insurance and all those things that contribute to people getting regular medical attention.
Oh, that's what people need to remember, that it's more to it. I agree, Dr. Adams. I have a quick question based on even what you just said. But before I do that, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the Will Group. Thank you for supporting this show and supporting the chamber. Just wanted to give them a shout out real quick. But when you talk about the food deserts, the health deserts, all the deserts, all the places where we are not on equal footing, if you will, where do you all in your field now, where are the opportunities, right? Where are people, black folks, able to say, here's a way for us to have a business to help our own people in this particular industry?
Well, I'll say this. One of the things that has always been historically important is not only who is getting served, but who is doing the serving.
That's right.
And what has historically happened is, you know, black people have always been what I call part of the consumer class. In other words, there is somebody extracting value from what black people provide or what is being provided to black people and using that value to enhance and enrich their own communities while taking the funding out of the African American community.
That's our whole existence in this country, right? That's our whole existence in this country that's been happening.
And that's absolutely correct. And you see that happening across all sectors. And now that's including healthcare. So there is money being provided to try to assist as best they can, African Americans in coping with this pandemic. And yet what you see is a lot of that money is now being transferred outside of the community, which leaves us now economically dependent on the majority community and the like. And so one of the things that comes along with this influx of money should be the economic empowerment of our communities. And despite, you know, what everybody says, nobody knows what's best for black people more than black people do. And so the opportunity is there now for us to step in and be part of our own economic destiny. And there are opportunities here, there, and everywhere for us to do that.
And, you know, just piggybacking on Marlo there, I think the other thing we know is that black people have better medical outcomes when they are treated by black people. That means two things. That means that not only do we need to be in these spaces, but we need to proliferate ourselves. So as we're looking at planning, as we're looking far ahead, we're talking about getting more of us in the field, more of us who can do this work, more of us who can form companies that allow black people to be able to come to somebody that they know and trust to provide them with the services that are important for their community. And that we realize that we don't have to be the subcontractors to our own wellness, that we need to be the direct link between ourselves and our communities in the things that we need. We need to organize to do so, and we need to recognize that these are just not humanitarian issues. These are political issues, and we have to deal with them at political levels as well.
That brings up a good point, if I may, Larry. I want to follow up with what you just said, Dr. Adams. So, reading in, I work in government and do some government work.
Right.
So I was reading the Capitol Facts about a human service contract that is currently only has 1% participation on it. I really asked the first question to talk about the opportunities, and you led right into this. You know, in terms of having the law that says that, you know, we're supposed to get X amount of dollars for all this the government spend. Now, I'm thinking about healthcare where there's huge dollars. You know, when reading that ad, you know, one would think that that goal should have been 20%, or even, to be honest, what you just said now would actually require somebody from the community actually doing the work, which would, you know, that would be supporting what the state is supposed to do. And I just want to get your feedback on that. If you were, you know, I'm pretty sure, you're aware of it. But yeah, if you could just tell our audience, like, what's happening? This is a perfect example.
I think, first of all, there is definitely a lack of transparency and a lack of vigilance sometimes in terms of what goes on once these goals are set. A lot of times, regular folks think when they read in the paper about these goals that, hey, I know for sure these things are not happening. They don't know about the deals that get made. They don't know that later on the companies will say, well, we tried, but we couldn't find anybody. We couldn't find any black people. Remember back when they used to say, no qualified blacks have applied, you know? So deals get made and folks say, okay, you don't have to do 20, come in with 5. Then they'll say, okay, we'll come in with 5. Then they come back after they already got the contracts and say, we could only do 1. And it becomes acceptable. Nobody puts them out. And it's like, you're already there. It's hard for us to get anybody else. They put the state or the agency between a rock and a hard place when it comes to being able to provide services by pretending at first that they're going to meet a goal and then not meeting it. Okay? Mm. And we as a community have to do the kind of due diligence and vigilance that has us taking a look at these things after the fact and making certain people are complying, because they are robbing us.
Right. Absolutely.
Just straight, plain, and simple, this is a jacking.
Mm. Now, how's that for an exclamation point?
Let me pivot just for a moment. You know, we're talking about health care, and I want to drill this down to Illinois. So if someone, whoever would like to answer this question, if someone could talk about, you know, there was a contract that I remember because I was involved in it and helping to make sure there was some black participation in the contracts. And the contracts were about $19 billion. Someone give us some idea in terms of how much do we spend on health care. And then what we want to do, we want to pivot into the conversation on the problem and, more importantly, the solution. And what does the solution look like? And I think we talk about SEMCO at that point in time. So someone give us an idea in terms of how much money we're spending in health care and how much money are we getting back in return when it comes to health care.
Okay, I'll try that.
Go ahead, Marlo.
Go ahead, Dr. Sterling. I'll yield.
No, please.
Y'all excited about answering this one. Come on. Yep.
Well, here we go. So I'll just say, you know, we started out with a $19 billion spend in healthcare and the like. One of the issues we have is that they have so narrowly defined what it is you can get that you never stop to think of the flip side. And the flip side is when they tell you how much you can get, they're also telling you how much you can't. And the fact of the matter is that when you talk about 20%, you would be thinking they are talking about 20% of the entire $19 billion pie, which is a respectable $3.8 billion. And I think if there were $3.8 billion flowing into the African-American community, we probably wouldn't have much of a topic for discussion.
Absolutely.
However, what they've done is now they've set up and narrowly defined what's meant by that 20%. And they say, well, that's 20% of the administrative spend, which is now a much smaller piece of the overall pie. So once you start talking about what that 20% of administrative spend is, so the administrative spend now totals out to maybe $4.25 billion. So we're looking at $850 million that we're now eligible to get. And this is not just black people. This is minorities, period. Now,
Hello.
what they you know, and so now what you have is you now have not only a small piece of the pie, but you're fighting over what I call a small piece of the small piece. And what they've done, so this $850 million goal, which is certainly a watered-down version of the $3.8 billion that you'd hope you'd get, they've only, up until this point, we've only seen about $121 million of that funding, of the $850 million that you would expect go to African-American businesses. And so what that means is there is a great deal of economic underinvestment. And because there is nothing that is mandating people to go out and look for these African-American businesses, this underinvestment continues. And instead of being aggressive about instead of the state being aggressive, as Larry mentioned, about going in and actually finding out how to resolve this problem, people seem to accept it and move on. And there's very little consequence for people who don't meet these goals.
Now, so I got to ask, I mean, so, and we're going to talk about specifics too here, but, you know, I like to get right to it. So my mother always would say, the question is why, right? If we know that what they're supposed to be, and if the number is $19 billion, because I agree with you totally, if we were getting $3.8 billion of business every year into our community, I dare say carjackings and a whole bunch of other things wouldn't be going on here in Chicago, right? But why not? So these people are supposed to be making sure that we get 20% in now, because I never worked directly in healthcare, but I just want to, why not? So is it the bigger companies that don't want to work with us and share that wealth? Are they lobbying for racist practices with government, or are people inherently just not wanting to give black people that business? I know it sounds like a very broad question, but I'm just wondering the resistance to do what's right.
Let's go back to our black history one more time.
Come on.
And let's go to Frederick Douglass.
Preach,
who said power concedes nothing without a demand and never has it and never will.
Right.
Okay? We've gotten much more silent than we were when we first got these particular set-asides. And we are tolerating a certain level of disrespect that we should not. That's why I so much appreciate what you're doing, Larry, with pushing the envelope and making certain that our government represents us as it should. But we need to provide the necessary supports for you there, and we need to provide the necessary incentives to them at the ballot box.
Thank you. Right. Let me ask this question. We just talked about one. What was happening in terms of healthcare disparity, and we also talked about the fact that healthcare outcomes, when it is culturally sensitive, have a more profound impact. It's better for us. And we mentioned all the money's being spent at the same time. And so we're at a point where we say, okay, a lot of money's being spent. What's the solution to the problem? So let's talk about Dr. Sterling. Tell us from your point of view, what solutions? Because our audience needs to know, you know, we got a problem, but do we have a solution?
Right. Well, we need to go back before we go forward. I think that so much has been said that we really should try to organize it to create a linear path toward what the proposed solutions on the table are. I think that at the beginning of the conversation, we should appreciate that this $19 billion, which, by the way, is only the subset of the state's healthcare spend on the state Medicaid initiatives, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that's not all the money in the state
that
goes toward healthcare. That's the money that goes toward state Medicaid expansion through the Affordable Care Act. So let's be clear about that. That's just one subset of what's not being given. The point of the matter is that, you know, I remember a conversation I had decades ago with the president of Harvard, who was talking about the origins of affirmative action. And this is not just a conversation about equity and justice. If you have a diverse society and you are interested in your society optimizing its impact and success, then all members of your society need to be equipped to succeed. Okay? So what that means is this entire notion of minorities, generally speaking, is a flawed concept. We need to create a system that encourages and demands full participation. And this is, I have to tell you this story because it's relevant and a perfect analogy to what we see here. When South Africa got rid of apartheid, there was a question of, well, how do you transfer the economy from basically all of the whites that historically ruled and owned everything to blacks that are a representative and, in fact, a majority of the population? The answer to the question was quite simple. They demanded it. It was compulsory. There were no contracts that were given from the government that did not include 80% African participation. So at some point in time, you just have to make it compulsory. And, you know, to that end, if you really are serious about participation, then you have to start with the notion that, hey, guess what? Black folks are competent. Minorities are competent. And so much so that white folks really can get comfortable with the notion of being subcontractors to blacks in the same way that minorities have been comfortable being subcontractors to whites. So at some point in time, we have to call upon our legislators and decision makers to simply make the decision. Let's stop talking about goals and start talking about dictates. Let's stop talking about you will attempt to identify minority participation and set it up so that your success is completely dependent on your inclusion of representative parts of the state. So there's a shift that needs to occur in the way these contracts are written, and the enforcement arms of these contracts needs to get some teeth, because at this point, you know, folks are getting participation trophies in the amount and to the extent of billions of dollars, where, as Marlo pointed out, you start out with a 20% goal, as is to use the language, and then it whittles all the way down to 1% or nothing, and then you're left with, out of a $19 billion spend, only $100 million being sprinkled across all the minorities in the state. How can we possibly accept that? So, hard stop there. The next thing I will point out in answering your question is that, look, guys, the FUBU proposition is very much real. Public health data literally shows that better outcomes are produced by culturally sensitive and specific providers of care. And that means that if you have black physicians and black business individuals that are providing services in communities, you're actually going to do a better job of eliminating some of those healthcare disparities and other considerations. We as a community have to do a better job of supporting each other, servicing each other, and looking toward what comes next, collaborating together. You know, it has to be something that we talk about outside of just the week of Kwanzaa, where we talk about collaborative and collective economics. Part of this, and people will always tell you, they can't find binders of black folks. They can't find black folks with the capacity to do what a Blue Cross Blue Shield does. Well, of course. But guess what? There are so many successful black businesses now that if you created a patchwork quilt of what our capabilities are, we very easily could not only approximate, we could actually exceed, in many examples, the work that's being done. Because if you actually look at the outcomes of some of the large service providers, they are doing a good job in our communities. They are doing a good
That's
job
right.
in healthcare.
Right.
Look at That's the
right.
outcome. This is an
big
outcome.
Big is not necessarily better.
Right.
You know, we talk about too big to fail, but in fact, these folks are failing.
Exactly.
And we simply don't have the will to call them on the carpet about it. So, yes, so this is about opportunity. And our approach, and Larry, I don't know if you want to transition over into the SEMCO solution. Part of what we are suggesting is that we actively work on building a bridge such that our community not only is empowered but competent to meet the challenges. I ask the question all the time, how does the current process ever create a bridge by which we stop fighting for ever decreasing smaller pieces of a small pie to where we actually get the skill sets? If you look at the criteria, it's institutional racism at its worst, where you have criteria that nobody can ever meet because they're never being given the opportunity. So my question is, how do you ever create a bridge such that we can stop being subcontractors and actually compete as primes? If you can't answer that question, it's because the bridge hasn't been built and it's never going to happen. So a big part of what we've been talking about inside of SEMCO is collective economics such that we pull together the resources of multiple. We actually literally have about 100 different businesses as part of our cooperatives that we pull together and create capacity in a greater way than any of us individually with display capacity. And we have some mighty fine businesses that are part of the collaborative who have done quite well on their own. But when you bring us all together and now we start targeting some of these contracts and opportunities and compelling our community to support us and work with us in ways that haven't been done, everyone knows the story of how quickly the money leaves our communities relative to other demographics. Well, that's how you get it done. And that's where it is we need to go. So we can now apply that to the opportunities and the challenges that exist in the state, because you would think that with a Democratic supermajority in the House and the governor's house that we'd have a receptive audience to empowerment of minorities above what has occurred historically. So if you get all that, then that set the table for some more specific conversations. But I just wanted to really put that in this context.
So let me.
I think what's beautiful about it, too, is that you have to do these things with intention. You have to decide that you're going to craft and put together a strategy that, in fact, achieves the goals that we have economically. It doesn't happen by everybody just going on their own randomly and hoping that somebody will give an opportunity. You have to organize, galvanize, and then bust the door down.
Right. You know what? There was a lot. There's a lot wrapped up in what Dr. Sterling was saying, and I think I want to make sure everybody understands. But what he talked about was saying, you know, that there needs to be a bridge built, and technically, there's a law already saying that bridge should be built. And so I think what you also said is there's enforcement issues, and I think that is where I think a lot of this lies. Look, skill sets are developed by doing work. You build an economy based on people needing a service or a good, right? And so if you have a goal that says this much of that business is going to go to a black business, right? This much of this work is going to go to a black business. What will happen is people will develop the skill sets because they want to get that contract, right? That's how business is developed in any racial group. So when they take away the opportunity, you never have the ability to develop those skill sets. And I think that makes the real, that's why I asked the question earlier. When we talk about the prevention or unwillingness to see it through, and you mentioned Blue Cross Blue Shield, I'm glad you did, because that's a company, they have a whole foundation, they got how we give to this in the community, but even they won't meet their goals that they have, and they have several healthcare contracts with the state. So the question is, you know, all of these companies are trying to keep the dollars to themselves. We get that. Mm-hmm. So the real people that are really responsible for the enforcement and creating these opportunities for us to develop these skill sets and get this work and, you know, get some of these billions that basically what you just said earlier, too, Dr. Sterling was, I think it was Dr. Sterling, but we're losing billions of dollars, right? And then we're losing lots of people. So the thing to me is, if we had the money, we lose less people, develop our communities, right? So Dr. Adams said they're jacking us. They absolutely are. So let's focus on, in terms of our solution, I'd like to ask, as I present this, and I know Dr. Adams, you worked in government. When we say they're not enforcing, are we really, we're talking about the governor? Are we talking about somebody that works for him? Because I feel like the governor should be able to say, these people are in crisis. Y'all work for me. Go help them. Because if we were in a flood zone, if we were in a flood zone in the spring and the flood came through, they're going to come down there and bring the sandbags. If it's a tornado coming through southern Illinois, they're going to come down there and feed everybody and fix their homes. Black folks are dying on the street, and they don't give us no business. I'm trying to get the correlation here.
Right. The lack of enforcement runs through the system from the top to the bottom to the in-between, to the agencies themselves, to people who sometimes function as gatekeepers instead of game changers. And that's what we need to move into. We see in various situations, let me give you an example, housing. Remember when, in order to get the federal money for a major housing development, they had to put some affordable housing in there?
Right.
And so then you found big high-rise developments that had affordable housing because, after all, they wanted to get that money.
Right.
But then they came up with a way to avoid it. They said, hey, what if we pay you some money not to have to do that?
Right.
Okay? And they started paying the city not to have to have any affordable housing as part of that project. And the city said, well, that's all right. We'll use that money to develop in your neighborhood through TIFs and what have you. And then turned around and used the money to continue to develop downtown.
Yep. That's exactly okay. what happened. Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah.
And got away with it. Now, if we said to one of these medical companies, if you can't find any black folks because you say nobody is trained in that area, then we're going to need 25% of your profits to put in a pool so we can train and find and recruit people to help you meet your goal. Mm. There needs to be a financial penalty associated
right.
with not meeting your goal, and that is not happening.
Dr. Adams and Dr. Sterling and Marlo, let me ask this question, because I think this is such an important conversation. Unfortunately, we don't have enough time, but we got to take this time, this moment in time, to try to convey to people how important this is, because black lives really matter. You know, when we take a look at all the money they're spending, the healthcare outcomes that we're getting, which are not very good, and we know it, and we have a solution. And if the states were to take $500 million and put it into a system that you guys run that would give us health outcomes that would be better, wouldn't it make more sense? Let's talk about the economics of sick care and health care and what the cost is. Can someone – I'll give that to Marlo or Dr. Sterling.
Go ahead, Marlo. You know, to jump in on that, and thank you for that question, Larry. You know, there one thing is that health care and health in general of a population is inextricably linked to the economic empowerment. So if you go throughout history, you'll find that poor people have worse health care outcomes across the board, no matter how far back you go. What we see here and you know, what we found through our study is that the average cost of an emergency room visit, for example, is somewhere in the neighborhood of $2,500. And this rolls back into the fact that you don't have a network in the black community that precludes you from going to the hospital as soon as something goes wrong, as opposed to treating that at the most cost-effective and effective period level of care. And so that's one aspect, that you're overspending by having people walk right into the emergency room. The second part of this economic empowerment piece is that you have a lot of money that is simply passing through the black community to provide service to black people, but the people who are providing that service and therefore reaping a good deal of the economic benefit are most of the time not black. And so what you have happening there then is we have something going on and we're being treated for things that are not economically beneficial to us in the manner in which these services are provided. And so what's needed is, again, the question of not having enough qualified black people, I believe, is simply not true. What is more often true is that these qualified black people are not in the networks and they're right. not in the room when this money is being doled out. And so because they're not, they're simply overlooked, and you never really address the economic issue that underlies all of this. So Martin Luther King, when he actually, in the late 60s, before his assassination, he was actually starting to focus on the economic issues because he saw that political power that did not lead to economic power was really an empty plate at the table.
It was no power at all. That's right.
Exactly. And so now what we're saying is, look, we certainly appreciate the fact that we're putting this money into health care and the like. But now it's our turn to say there's economic empowerment out here. There are black companies that can do the work and will do the work well and will commit to doing it. And we have just as much a right to sit at the table and be a part of this whole economic pie, not just the administrative pieces where you get some, where we can sit there and have you be the director of diversity or what right. have you, which is a good spot. But we're like, you know, we want to be into the position where we can sit and actually help determine our health outcomes.
Hey, Marlo,
being passive participants. Yes,
Marlo, I'm going to interrupt you because I want to pass this to Dr. Sterling also, but I want to quickly make this comment. We always say, if you're not at the table, guess what?
You on the menu.
You know, yep. So we got to get at the table so we can get off the menu. Dr. Sterling?
We got to set the
table. Could I interest you in this? Let's just
take a step back again. There's $19 billion being spent in state Medicaid expansion delivery. That translates, a 20% target would be $3.8 billion. We aren't even close to that. We're not even in the ballpark of $100 million, okay? And that's across all diversity span, inclusive of minorities. And by the way, white women actually get approximately 51% of what's designated as the diversity span. That's a mess. We've talked about that enough. But could I interest you in a proposal that at the beginning of the conversation on the healthcare side, the public healthcare side, would actually improve healthcare outcomes in the state of Illinois by focusing on prevention? We've known forever, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. No one is talking health prevention and health promotion, but around the world, it is how better healthcare outcomes get produced, not this paradigm of sick care that stimulates the economy, which is what's being done in the United States, which is why we're ranked 37th in terms of a healthcare delivery system. But what if I told you that for the cost of not $3.8 billion, not even $1 billion, but for the cost of $500 million, we could actually empower over 100 African-American businesses to an average of $1 million per company, mobilize that group, and implement preventive health and health promotional strategies that produce better healthcare outcomes up and down in every part of the state. Black folks, Latinos, as well as majority population. That is what the Simcoe solution is. We have been shovel ready for several months. We've been having multiple conversations with our legislative allies. We've been talking with the Department of Health and Family Services. We've talked to the Lieutenant Governor. We have talked to any and everyone in the state. No one disagrees on the facts of the public health proposal. No one disagrees on the merits of what we're trying to do, or the benefits or the jobs that we'll create or the businesses that we'll stimulate. We need to find the political cojones to make such a thing happen. We're not even talking about one-for-one representation. We're talking about starting off at the table. The Simcoe solution is something that if we weren't so distractible and if those in power weren't so disingenuous, would be an excellent starting point. It's not a big ask, and in the midst of the community being ravaged by COVID-19, this should be on the table as an emergency appropriation tomorrow, because in Chicago, more than half of the deaths are coming from the African-American community. Malcolm, you asked a question about who is not supporting this. The correct question, sir, is find me somebody who actually is supporting it. And there are specific individuals. We've had some tremendous support inside of the Legislative Black Caucus and otherwise. But, you know, again, I'm not talking about activity. I'm talking about accomplishment.
Yeah. No, Dr. Stirling, that's a good point. I think, you know, one of the things, we do need to focus on who the people that are supporting us are. I think we got a couple of calls here that want to ask some questions to the group. Larry, go ahead. Let's see what we got.
The first caller, Linda, you're on.
Yes, my question is this. The immigration laws, when they sign them immigration laws into effect, what do it break down as far as health is concerned, housing and everything else? We never get a breakdown of them laws. They come in getting what we get, or better, and that's not fair. That's not. Mm. I mean, every president that come in, they talk about for immigration. What about us? You never talk about us. Black people that's already here, health-wise and housing. You always talk about an immigration law. Yeah. What do the immigration law consist of that's going to hurt us?
Yeah,
that's my question.
Yeah. And let me just say this real quick, is that if you take a look at this election, all of us know that President Biden would not have been elected if it had not been for black people.
No way.
We need to be clear on that.
Right.
So is there, Dr. Adams, you want to answer that question for Linda? Yeah. Then we're going to go to our next caller because we're running out of time. And I know we don't have enough time, but go ahead, Dr. Adams, if you would like to respond to Linda, that would be great.
Well, I think the point is that we have to represent our own interests and we have to demand for what we give. We give much. We've given much to this country. We built it. And we should extract from it everything that we are owed. You know, as Martin Luther King said, they got a check and it came back non-sufficient funds. We need ours.
That's right.
Okay?
Absolutely.
We need to collect. And we need to not be afraid to talk about money. There are certain people in our community that feel that if you talk about that, somehow you're being crass, that you just have to talk about ideals and things like that. But it is the lack of economic empowerment that is devastating our communities. And so we have to not be afraid to say, show me the money.
Right. Pay up.
The next caller is Brother Raheem. Go ahead.
Good morning. How are you folks doing? I'm giving my salutes to all four of you. But I grew up on the south side of Chicago. We had Dr. Counts, Dr. Jeffries, Dr. Lawless. What happened to those doctors? Well, I know what happened to them, but I mean, my thing is the doctors that started going to school didn't come back to the community.
The medicine changed.
We had tents everywhere. These were in walking distance. Dr. Count, Dr. Lawless. And the other thing was people were coming into our community because these were specialists. And I just named a skin specialist. I just named a general practitioner for children, and a dentist.
Yeah,
absolutely.
They were in our community.
Brother Reem, thank you for your question.
Dr. Sterling?
Dr. Sterling?
Well, the truth of the matter is that perception is reality, but there's both a relative and absolute consideration going on here. African-American physicians have never approximated our proportion as members of society. So what you have described from early on was the glory days of representation in black neighborhoods. That's not the norm. That really was the exception. The public health data shows without a doubt that we are scores more likely to work in our own communities than any other population. So the issue is to grow the pool. Right now, you're talking about black physicians only being 4% of all physicians nationally. There's just not enough of us to go around. But I assure you that when we exist, we tend to gravitate toward these communities. And there have been several initiatives along the way that have sought to increase the pool of black physicians in total. And I think that's really the way to address the question. Black physicians, through the National Medical Association and otherwise, are really keen on trying to make a difference because you made us, and we exist because of the struggles to get us and to help us become physicians. So the challenge really is growing the pool, and I think the concern that you're expressing would take care of itself in that regard. And that's where we have to continue to fight.
Dr. Sterling, you
Dr.
have a
Dr. Sterling,
gentleman.
Let me ask a question. Are we seeing also the impact of fewer people going into what used to be called private practice and more people being affiliated with hospitals and such as opposed to just hanging out their own shingle?
Hmm. Believe me, that's another hour conversation to go down that rabbit hole, but I will tell you that the pool of black physicians is diminishing, especially the pool of black men physicians. New entrants in healthcare amongst physicians are 80% women these days, which is a different conversation, but there needs to be a dramatic increase in the number of black physicians. Now, 194,000 new nurse practitioners came on board who were filling some of the voids of primary care. So you're now going to see less physicians in those spaces. Physicians these days are becoming specialists more, and physician assistants and nurse practitioners are taking up the spaces that used to be populated by us. But, you know, that's a huge issue and a different conversation.
Yeah, wow. Dr. Sterling, you have someone on your team that is a leader in that area. You want to just tell us quickly because we want to get one more question, and then we're going make a couple announcements.
Of course, Dr. Neva Lubin-Johnson actually is our chief health officer. She is a recent past president of the National Medical Association, which since 1895 has been the representative body of this country's 50,000 physicians. She herself worked in Chatham for about 30 years. In fact, she was my mother's physician. And we've had so many conversations about exactly what the caller talked about. And just as it's hard extracting money out of governments and out of corporations, imagine trying, you've heard the suits where every time we try to get a proportionate amount of blacks admitted to medical school, we get reverse discrimination suits and the like. This isn't something that gets into the public dialogue very often, but it's a very real thing. And there are individuals like her and me who fight that fight all day, every day. But it's a struggle, as so many things are in terms of relinquishing or grasping power from those that hold it.
So let me ask this question, because we're going to be making a transition. And correct me, Malcolm, my co-host here, so if I get a little bit off track, he can get me back on track. We have a problem with health care, that blacks are dying at a higher rate. We have sick care, and we have preventive care. And preventive care is much better. We also have culturally sensitive things. The state is spending a lot of money. but they're not spending money with black business. You guys have a solution that is best based upon best practices that save a significant amount of money. As I listen to you, $85 compared to $500-something. And what we need to do, I think, is that we got to make sure our voices are heard. We got to demand out of all this money in health care that we have something that will save black lives. And if we don't stand up and fight for it and call our legislators and call the governor and make sure that this concept that has been proven all around the world works, then we have failed ourselves. So give me some closing comments, Dr. Sterling, Dr. Adams, and Marlo, quick comments in terms of where do we go next? What do you tell our audience next? And then Malcolm's going to close us out with any other comments, and I think we'll be just about on time. So at this time, if we can get some quick comments, and then we'll make a quick announcement about the event coming up for Black History Month. Go ahead. We'll start with Marlo. Marlo, if you can make it quick, and then that way we'll give Dr. Sterling the last comments.
Yes, and thank you. And thank you again for having us. What I'll say is, again, remember that economic empowerment and health are not two mutually exclusive things. In fact, they are so closely linked together that we need to kind of proceed and look at them as if they are one single entity. And so our focus on health care is not only for minorities, is not only that, it's also a focus on empowering our communities so that can kind of create a ripple effect that then helps not only people who are sick, but you also help people who are actually well by preventing them from getting sick and by giving them positive economic outcomes too.
Thank you. Dr. Adams.
Well, I believe that we need to be vigilant and we need to help our legislators help us. I'm very proud of the work that came out of this last session from the Illinois black legislators. Some of us are represented by non-black legislators. We need to be pushing the envelope. We need to be calling them, writing them. We need to be demanding that we get the economic representation in the state that we deserve and for which we are well qualified.
I like it.
Dr. Shirley.
None other than Barack Obama said, hey, I'm a politician. If you want me to do something, force me to do it. We have to get out of the notion that there's some sense of osmosis that will create a steady state or a normal playing field. People, if left to their own devices, will continue to do what they've historically done. And that's a big part of why healthcare disparities and all the types of islands that we talk about exist. Look, folks, we have, like Carol said, I have been amazed at the desire of many members of the General Assembly to do the right thing. We have to continue to get in their faces and in their ears and to give them subject matter expert testimony so that they can identify what to do. But we have to avoid this inclination to be distracted, because the people that hold the money and the people that aren't interested in specifically supporting our communities are just incredibly masterful at distracting and moving the goalposts and doing all other types of things. Hell, I might be demonized as a result, as a means of doing that type of thing. There's so many tools in the toolkit of oppression that we don't even realize what's happening to us until we do a summary look back and see, hey, we haven't gotten anything. All of the businesses that would be affected and all the members that would be employed, let's get on board.
Right on.
Malcolm, we got about 35, 40 seconds before we have to close.
Quick. Okay. I'm going to make it real quick. First of all, I want to again say thank you to the Will Group for their support. Where there's a will, there's a way. Steve Davis, thank you. Thank you. But my last statement is this. Governor Pritzker, if black lives matter, help our people help themselves and enforce the participation goal. Tell the people that work for you that this is a priority for you and let us hear it. And on top of that, I would say sign Senate Bill 1608, because we know that bill has a lot for African Americans, and in Black History Month, it would mean a lot to us. So I say that and making sure that we keep the pressure on the folks that can help us. I want to thank you all for, you know, really enlightening even myself and I hope our audience on how much money is in healthcare, but also how much opportunity is in healthcare. And with that, you know, we keep the struggle.
One last thing real quick. Hey, we have an event on Black History. We're celebrating Black History to strengthening Black business. We have close to 30 to 40 colleges who are purchasing agents who are looking to sit in front of Black business to improve their spend. So look out for the information we have that's backed by the CPO, John Donato, and also by the ICCB, which controls the junior colleges. So we're going to have a great time. Again, let's thank our host. I mean, let's thank not our host.
We're thanking you, Larry.
Let's thank our guests and then thank WBOEN for such a wonderful job that they do. Have a wonderful day.
All right. Yeah.